Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. My name is Lauren Litton, and I am the host of the show. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That number once again is 347-994-1149, and then you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you'll be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. In March, we had a show on dismantling the school-to-prison pipeline in Ohio, and it had a great response. This is a companion show focusing on children with behavioral disabilities who are extremely vulnerable to the school-to-prison pipeline. Our guests are going to outline strategies and considerations for schools and legal advocates working with these youth to help remove barriers to receiving education and addressing behavioral issues in ways that prevent or limit exposure to the juvenile justice system. Both our guests today work at Ohio Legal Rights Services, also known as OLRS, which is an independent disability rights advocacy agency and serves as a federal protection and advocacy system in the state of Ohio for people with disabilities. Susan Tobin is the chief legal counsel and has worked at OLRS for more than 28 years. She manages the intake department, reviews all requests for services, and assigns cases to attorneys and advocates. Sue assists in the development of office policies and administrative rules and enforces the agency's statutorily granted access to clients, facilities, and records. She also represents clients, develops advocacy resources, conducts training, and provides analysis and comment on public policy matters. She has litigated numerous federal cases, including class actions. Some of the highlights of these include retaining critical services to children with autism, preserving voting rights for homebound voters, fostering the creation of the Children and Family First Interagency, and challenging a special education funding structure which limited services and discriminated against more than 280,000 Ohio students with disabilities. Kristen Hildenbrandt is a supervising attorney, has practiced in the area of disability and special education law for 21 years, and manages OLRS's special education unit. In addition to her managerial responsibilities, Kristen represents children and parents in special education cases and represents individuals with disabilities in class-based litigation. Kristen is a lead attorney in a statewide class action involving Ohio's implementation of Medicaid's early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment program for children. She's a frequent speaker on the topic of special education, juvenile justice, and the school-to-prison pipeline and disability law. Kristen received her law degree from The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law and is admitted to practice in the United States District Court for both the Southern and Northern Districts of Ohio and the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. So I would like to welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Kristen, perhaps you can start us off. As I mentioned, in March we had another show on the school-to-prison pipeline. But as a review, if you can remind our listeners and maybe those who weren't even on earlier, what do we mean by the school-to-prison pipeline?
Sure. The school-to-prison pipeline is basically a conduit from school to juvenile justice and on to adult corrections. It primarily captures and affects children who are living in poverty, children of color, and children who have disabilities, especially disabilities that affect their behavior in the school setting. And those are the kids really that we're going to be focusing on today. There are a couple of things that propel kids through this pipeline. The first, in my opinion, is really a failure of instruction in schools, and that failure leads to low-performing kids who are likely to drop out of school and consequently get in trouble and then encounter the juvenile justice system and adult prison. Failures in instruction can occur in a lot of areas. They occur because school districts fail to address the difference in learning styles for a lot of the students that we represent. They fail to make instruction relevant because there's so much emphasis on teaching to test these days. We fail to make instruction relevant to the life of the child who's being instructed. Schools also have difficult times sometimes individualizing methodologies, particularly when we're talking about teaching kids with disabilities how to read. And we all know that children who can't read well don't do well in life. And another thing I think, too, that's important and a lot of people don't talk about is that schools don't spend the time necessary to create a supportive school community prior to engaging in the actual business of teaching academics. And creating that basis where children respect each other, don't bully each other, and get along goes a long way towards helping to control the behavior of all the students in the school. So failed instruction, I think, is the first thing that helps to keep that school-to-prison pipeline going. And the other thing, too, is that we've all heard about schools and their zero-tolerance programs regarding discipline of all children, essentially. So that emphasis on that zero tolerance really creates an atmosphere where there's an emphasis on discipline as opposed to an emphasis on teaching, which leads to referral to juvenile justice and ultimately adult corrections. And several things schools do in this zero tolerance climate is to overuse suspension and expulsion and alternative placements for kids with disabilities. So their focus is on getting kids out of school as opposed to implementing behavioral supports and techniques that will keep kids in school. And a lot of schools have really beefed up their in-school resource officer program. So a lot of schools are being policed pretty much on a daily basis, which really, again, puts the emphasis on that instead of teaching.
Yeah, and I would just add that. Oh, I'm sorry. I would just add that a lot of what we see is caused by a school's failure to identify a child as having disabilities, and not recognizing that some of the behavior that they are seeing may be related to a disability that's not being treated or addressed, and so that sometimes leads to it, as well as really a lack of support for teachers or training on how to teach appropriate behavior, and so all that teachers are left with as a tool is discipline.
Great. I was just going to ask you to maybe explain even what a resource officer is for those who don't know, but you gave a really great overview, especially on the educational side of the school-to-prison pipeline. But if you could tell us more about how Ohio Legal Rights Services became involved in this issue.
Well, We are, this, as you mentioned, the State Protection and Advocacy Agency. So we provide all sorts of legal advocacy to people with disabilities. And I would say a large portion of what we do is special education law. And just through referrals to our agency and calls from parents, we identified the overuse of discipline for students with disabilities as a big issue. And I think it's safe to say, I don't know if you agree with me, Sue, that that is the primary call that we receive in the special education arena, would be around kids who have disabilities with a behavioral component, and the child is either being suspended, expelled, or served poorly because of the district's inability to get a handle on that behavior. So it really comes, it's driven a lot by the calls that we receive.
And sometimes it is actually school officials who are initiating the juvenile justice system involvement in the matter. A teacher may have been injured in an altercation with a student where perhaps the school has been using restraint on a child without being trained in adequately in de-escalation techniques. And so what starts off as a relatively minor behavioral incident escalates, and the child is defending him or herself from hands-on, particularly when children have sensory issues, it can be very traumatic for them to be touched. And so sometimes, unfortunately, this results in injuries not only to children, but to the people who work in the school, and sometimes charges are filed, which lead to the school-to-prison pipeline.
Well, you mentioned sensory issues. We're using the term behavioral disabilities. What does that mean, and what does it encompass?
It's, you know, there's a widespread misunderstanding that in order for behavior to be the result of a disability, that the label that a child has to have what ordinarily we would consider a behavioral disability, like emotional disturbance issues. Behavioral disabilities, it's not so much a disability label. I think what best captures the concept is the National Association of State Directors of Special Education many years ago correctly said that negative behavior, especially for children, is a communication tool, and what it communicates is unmet needs. So children will act out, particularly children who have communication deficits, when their needs are not being met. And the same behavior in a different student can have a different function for that student. A child may act out because they want attention. Another child might be acting out because the work is too hard for them and they're frustrated. Some children have impulse control issues that's not adequately controlled even when they're on medication, and so they can't sit still. And in a classroom where they're required to sit still and not get up and move around, it can be very difficult for that child, and again, things escalate. So it can run the gamut from pencil tapping to children who really act out with aggression. So it really runs the gamut, and it's not necessarily tied to any diagnosis or disability category label that the school may or may not have placed on a child. And what's really important in my experience of close to 30 years in this area is a lot of times when I see this behavior, to me it's a red flag, and I will ask the parent or another provider who may be involved in the child's care, has this child been a victim of trauma, either primary or secondary? And what we mean by that is, have they been physically abused? Have they been sexually abused? Have they been emotionally abused? Or have they been an observer of that in someone very close to them? And a lot of times this behavior, if you dig down far enough and deep enough, you will find that so many of these children have behaviors as a result of traumatic experiences that they have had.
And I agree with Sue, and I think I would add one more comment, and that is that it's important to look at not necessarily what the child's educational label is or even what their disability is, but what impact is that behavior, no matter what it is, having on their ability to make progress in school and on their educational plan, assuming that they have one. So it's really looking at the outcomes, what kind of outcomes are occurring for that student because of that behavior.
All right. And I want to let our listeners know that we did have a show on trauma-informed care, and it explored the issue of trauma on children. So if they wanted to hear more about that, they could look for that on demand. So you mentioned a little bit about the calls that you're getting and the overuse of discipline, expulsion, suspension. So those sound like some of the ways traditionally the schools have responded to children with behavioral disabilities. Can you tell us a little bit more about those traditional responses and maybe share some stories of youth and families that you've worked with and represented?
Well, once a child has been identified as having a disability and is placed on the individualized education plan, schools pretty typically understand that when there's behavior that interferes with that child's learning or the learning of others, and a behavior incident occurs in which they hope to impose discipline, first they need to do a manifestation determination. Federal law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and corresponding state law in Ohio and other states, I'm sure, require that school officials sit down with the parents and talk about and analyze what is going on with the child's behavior, what happens before, how do we respond to it, how does that impact the child, and try to figure out what I alluded to before is what is the function of that child's behavior. Is it avoidance? Is it overload? Is it attention seeking? Is it impulse control? Because only by understanding that function of the behavior can we come up with a positive behavior plan, and I want to emphasize that it is intended to be a positive behavior plan that will likely address this child's problem behavior in a positive way. And the idea is that the positive behavior plan teaches the child alternate desirable ways to respond to have that particular need met. And that is the way it is supposed to work, and sometimes it does work that way. But sometimes districts determine that behavior is not a manifestation or caused by the child's disability, and they will go ahead and impose discipline. We suggest to parents and advocates that if they have another provider who's involved in the care or treatment of a child, that they try to get support from that provider, be it a social worker or a psychologist, somebody who may have some insight into the behavioral difficulties a child's having and the cause for those behaviors, to support the position that behavior is a manifestation of the disability, and also to provide some input to sit down with the educational team to talk about a plan for addressing that behavior in a positive way that's likely to have positive results. Too many times, it's a one-size-fits-all program. There was a recent case that was decided by a federal court judge that talked about a traditional program that schools use as a point system where a child has to behave in a certain desirable way for so long, and then they acquire points, and then they may get some sort of reinforcement, you know, a toy or listen to the radio or something that they like. And the judge recognized that in some cases, those systems don't work for kids who don't have the cognitive ability to follow that kind of a program, that they're not effective. One of the other things that IDEA importantly requires is research-based instruction. And so many of the programs that schools use, there's no research to support the effectiveness of those programs. There's also supposed to be an ability to track whether something is working for a particular child. And so we always advise parents and schools, you need to collect data to show that what you're doing is having a positive impact. And if it's not, you should know pretty quickly. And instead of doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, the team needs to get together and sit down and talk about an alternative strategy to address that behavior. Unfortunately, and it's understandable, schools sometimes get burned out or frustrated, but we can never blame the child for our failure. It is our failure as the adults, as the teachers, in figuring out how to address a child, because all children can learn. We just have to figure out the strategies that will enable them to do that. And Kristen, maybe you have some stories to share.
Oh, sure. There are a lot of stories to share, but I wanted to make a comment, add on to what you just said, Sue. I think also sometimes that the adults in this process need to remind themselves that some of the discipline, and actually most of the discipline that's applied, is often preferable to the student. We have a lot of students who are getting suspended and removed from school, and that's actually a preferable thing for them. They don't want to be in school for a variety of reasons. They're being bullied, or they don't understand the work. It's too much for them. It's too stressful, too much sensory input. So we have to take a step back and say, and look at the traditional ways that we're trying to discipline students with these disabilities, and acknowledge that those types of responses are not going to work, because they are indeed preferred by the students. And we've had many, many cases where kids have been suspended numerous times during a school year, and so it's an extreme amount of work to try to reverse that and try to get that child encouraged to go back to school and stay in school. We have a lot of cases. I think what I'd like to highlight is that we are seeing kids being suspended for things that we would consider minor. So, for example, we have a case with a 9-year-old child with autism, pretty significant autism, who has a probation officer and juvenile court involvement because he would consistently crawl under his desk at school. And at the time we got involved in the case, there had been no effort by the school district to do any kind of a functional behavioral assessment to try to figure out what the function of that behavior is. So, you know, that child was crawling under that desk, I'm sure, for a variety of reasons. They were giving him work that was too hard that he didn't understand. They were putting too many demands on him, or the activity in the classroom was too great for his sensory needs. So, you know, those types of cases we are seeing a lot more, where kids are getting involved for what we would consider pretty minor, if even rising to the level of an infraction of the school code of conduct. We have seen an upsurge in cases for younger children with mental health issues, who are arrested or handcuffed in school. We currently have a case where a child with mental health issues was having a fit in school. The staff in the school were restraining him, and during the restraint, he hit one of the individuals restraining him. And that led to the police being called, the student being handcuffed, arrested, and guns actually being drawn. So this was a 9-year-old student. And through our involvement, he's now back in school. And this, all of this occurred in a what we call a behavioral school. So he was placed in a more restrictive setting outside of a public school. After our involvement, after encouraging the district to engage in appropriate positive behavioral planning and support, he's back in the public school in a less restrictive setting and doing actually remarkably well. So those are examples of the types of cases we see on a regular basis.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize, I'm sorry, what Kristen said in terms of the what I refer to as the inadvertent reinforcing of negative behavior, where schools think they're doing something that's punishing a child and actually it's reinforcing the behavior. I had an example of a girl who was 18 or 19. She was an adult, and she was passing notes to boys in school. And when the teacher tried to intervene, it escalated, and there was an altercation, and they ended up calling the police, and she wound up in jail. And I asked the school officials, and there was, I think, a county board of developmental disabilities involved, and whether this girl had ever been a victim of sexual abuse or trauma. And at first they said, no, not that we're aware of. And then they came back to me and they said, oh, we found out that she had been sexually assaulted on the school bus back in her past. And she was actually in jail, which wasn't a punishment for her because it was a great way for her to meet guys. And so she was taking phone numbers now, not just of class students, of students that were classmates of hers, but now criminals in jail, she was getting phone numbers for to get dates. So it was a horrible result. And once this was brought to light, the response changed that, gee, maybe this wasn't such a great thing to do for this child, and maybe we need to understand, well, adult, young adult, and maybe we need to understand the function of that behavior. I really do believe that, you know, if you have a child, you understand just how much of an expert a child is in behavior management and managing adults' behavior. We may not even be aware of it. So that piece of getting a bunch of minds together and sitting down with the child's interest to figure out the function of the behavior is absolutely critical in terms of addressing it in a positive way.
Okay. So I just want to spend maybe a little bit more time on the schools, and I really want to start focusing on the legal system. You talked about team meetings. What are, right now we have the school resource officers policing the schools. What are your recommendations for schools, though, who are seeking to change their responses to students with behavioral disabilities, and who should be involved in those changes?
I think that there are that we would have school-wide recommendations, and then individual recommendations if you're talking about working with a particular child. School-wide, I think it's a huge issue to increase the communication between building staff, and when I say building staff, I mean principal, assistant principal, resource officers, and special education personnel, because too often our cases, the discipline stems from the building principal, who probably doesn't know much about special education or that process, and what the district needs to do to provide appropriate behavioral support. So increasing that communication between that staff is important. As Sue mentioned before, training to staff about positive behavior modification and why behavior should be looked at as communication as opposed to bad kids acting badly is extremely important. I think that changing attitudes about this really changes the responses of that adults have to behavior and can go a long way towards a much more positive environment in the school as a whole. I also go back to what I said before, and that is I believe every school should spend some time at the beginning of every school year building the school community where positive behavior intervention is used for all children, and that kids are supported and not punished. Schools address bullying and why it's not going to be tolerated, and all those types of issues are recommendations for schools school-wide. I think in terms of the individual case, schools need to be proactive in responding to a child's behavior. We get cases where kids have been having behaviors for years and years and years, and it's gotten to the point of being significant enough that the child is referred to juvenile justice. So being very proactive as soon as behavior is observed, addressing that in a variety of ways. Obviously, we've talked a lot about them providing appropriate positive behavior supports and services. And I think one point that hasn't been made yet is that there needs to be a teaching component to any positive behavior plan. A lot of times schools will develop plans with goals that don't have any teaching component to them. So it's really unlikely the student's ever going to learn a positive replacement behavior for a negative one if there isn't an adult with some expertise teaching that child how to do that. It's just not magically going to happen. And I think also another point is that schools need to know when they need help. Schools have problems with kids with behaviors for a variety of reasons. Some just don't know what to do. Some know what to do, but lack of resources impedes their ability to provide appropriate services. And some just don't have expertise on staff in behavior support. So schools need to take a look at that, what resources they have available, and if they need to bring in outside expertise to assist the IEP team in developing behavior plans, they need to do that.
Yeah, I would just add that on a statewide level, we have been very concerned for many years that there is no regulation of the use of restraint seclusion in schools. These same children, when they are in a daycare setting or preschool, or if they were in a foster home or in any other setting, there would be some regulation and reporting of the use of restraint seclusion. Added to that fact that there's no training requirement. A while back, Governor Strickland, the governor of Ohio, had issued an executive order banning certain kinds of prone restraints after a child in residential care died. And state agencies were supposed to get together and come up with a statewide policy, and then each of the departments were to come up with rules. We're still waiting on rules from our Department of Education here in Ohio. There are many other states who have developed rules or statutes regulating the use of restraint, monitoring and notifying parents. A lot of times parents don't even know that their child has been restrained, and their child will come home with bruises or scratches, abrasions. And it's a really serious matter that these children are being restrained, possibly without training, and particularly, as we said, about the positive behavior supports to avoid the use of restraint to begin with. And you know, those of you who may have listened to the prior trauma program know that laying hands on these kids can re-traumatize them. So one of the actors I think that needs to be involved in this is your State Department of Education. They have a role and responsibility in setting up rules and ensuring that people are trained and providing support to school districts to handle these problems. I think a lot of what Kristen said is right on point, and when you know you need help, if you're a school official, in Ohio we have county boards of developmental disabilities. There may be a private provider who can come in and help, and it doesn't always have to cost money to do those things. But looking at behavior differently, looking at it as that it's something that can be taught, is a real significant shift that will go a long way towards helping schools help children.
Okay. So let's then turn our attention to the legal system, because there's one thing about an effort of the schools to keep children in and to provide the education. But for those still being sent through the court system, I'd like to help them, the court system, think about their response to the children that are before them. So do you have recommendations about how courts, so including judges, probation officers, and prosecutors, can reduce suspension and expulsion and keep kids in their communities and in school? Have you seen protocols around the country?
Actually, our office has spent quite a bit of time in the last several years going around the state providing training to Ohio County juvenile courts on this very issue, trying to give them some tools to what I call push back on those kids that are being referred to them. So, you know, for anybody who's a probation officer or with the courts who's listening, that certainly is something that we would be happy to do. I think primarily courts need to become educated about the school district responsibilities to provide positive behavioral supports to kids with disabilities. They're legally mandated to address any behaviors that are impacting negatively the student's education, or what we call a free appropriate public education. So they need to educate themselves that there are avenues that school districts can take and indeed have to take to try to support the child and keep the child in school. And I think once they become educated about that, they're going to feel more empowered to push back when they're getting referrals of students with disabilities for simple code of conduct violations. As I said earlier, we're seeing a lot more kids getting into the system for those kinds of violations, and that shouldn't be occurring. And if juvenile courts would push back on that and say, Have you district done appropriate behavior planning? Did you do a functional behavioral assessment to try to figure out why that behavior is occurring? Have you kept data to see if your behavior plan is working? And have you put the necessary supports and services in place? I think school districts would feel less that it would be harder to make those referrals, and they wouldn't simply go through so easily. So that's huge, I think. I also think that juvenile courts can develop protocols so when they are receiving referrals from school districts, they get the necessary information that they need to decide whether or not this is something that should be sent back to the special education process or dealt with by the court. So what I mean by that is they need to make sure they get copies of all the students' relevant special education records, have information about the disability, and determine whether or not the school did do what they were supposed to do. And for those cases where the school hasn't followed procedures, they can put their juvenile court case on hold and ask the school district to put those services in place with the hope that they can maintain the child in school without juvenile court involvement.
And I think there's a good program, at least I believe there was, in Cuyahoga County in Cleveland, where the juvenile court was collaborating with a local mental health agency, and the mental health agency would screen children coming into the juvenile court to see if there were undiagnosed mental health issues that may be affecting the behavior and leading to involvement with the juvenile justice system. And in Ohio, we have Children and Family First Councils that are interagency groups at every county that are supposed to look at multi-needs children, and typically the juvenile court plays a role in that. So it's really kind of a problem-solving rather than pointing fingers and saying this is a juvenile justice problem, it's not education's problem, or it's not mental health problem. It's to collaborate together the different systems to come up with a plan to serve a child's need and keep them out of the juvenile justice system. So even if a school district isn't technically a party to juvenile court proceeding, most school districts are going to listen when a judge asks the school people to come and talk about working collaboratively for the benefit of a child who has multiple needs. We've also worked with, first of all, it's very important to get these children, when they're involved in the juvenile justice system, defense counsel. We typically do not represent in criminal or juvenile court proceedings, but we want to make sure that parents know that they should try and get defense counsel for these children. And then we work collaboratively with those attorneys to educate them so that they can bring these issues to the attention of the juvenile court, sometimes filing briefs to get charges dismissed because what led to the child's juvenile court involvement was a lack of supportive services and not meeting their needs, which led to the behavior. Also, the federal law requires that when schools report a crime, that they need to transmit the child's records to the juvenile court. So that information that should be transmitted to the juvenile court can be very helpful to the court in understanding the child's disability, the child's behavioral challenges, and what has or has not been done to deal with those issues. So certainly that is something that juvenile court personnel can do in terms of getting information. And a lot of these kids tend to go in and out of systems, or they're highly mobile, and sometimes it's very challenging to try and get the records to follow the kid. We have worked with the Children's Law Center in Kentucky, with juvenile detention center, kids who are detained in juvenile detention centers, and they're not just there for a few days, and the work never follows them, their individualized plans never follow them, they don't get the special services which they're required to get. And so we have also worked on kids who are in detention centers and other kinds of facilities to make sure that they get the educational services, that it's not interrupted, because typically they're already behind, and they're only going to get further behind unless those services and those records catch up to them.
I think those are really good points, and I would expand a little bit by saying that just as courts need to educate themselves about the school's obligations to support kids, and that they also need to understand the child's disability, and that the remedies available to the juvenile court sometimes aren't going to be effective for a particular child because of that child's disability. I have a case right now with a student who has been involved in juvenile court for a long time, and she's there because of unruly behavior. There's only so much the juvenile court can do to her through the juvenile rules, and none of what they have available has impacted this child's behavior at all. She has continued to do the things that got her into juvenile court in the first place. And I think because the court doesn't have a lot of resources available to it, it should be focusing on ways to get those kids back into school where they actually could access resources that would teach them ways to modify that behavior that society is not wanting to see. So it's not a good place for those kids to be. And as Sue said, as they work their way through that process, the access to appropriate educational services gets less and less and less.
I want to remind our listeners that they can call in at 347-994-1149 if they would like to ask you a question live on air. Both of you really moved into children's attorneys and what they need to be thinking about and doing. And, in Ohio, we have 88 counties, many counties use court-appointed attorneys who might not necessarily even handle children's cases very much. So are there other things that you really want to make recommendations to how children's attorneys may even identify that a child that they're representing has behavioral disabilities? Perhaps they didn't even come directly from the school. Are there things that they should be asking and looking for?
Well, I think should try to get records from the school, look at discipline records, look at attendance records. Even if a child has not yet been identified, perhaps they should have been identified as eligible for special services. And those kind of records could be telling. If there are other systems that have been involved with the child, I think it'd be important to see what the history is, to see if there's been abuse, to see if there's been care transferred from parents to grandparents, and what kind of life this child has. Go ahead, Kristen. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, and you are thinking along the same lines. I mean, I just add to that, a lot of kids with disabilities have involvement with private community providers. It may be in mental health or through community agencies. So when an attorney is representing a child, they should thoroughly discuss with the parent their various different resources the child is involved with, and there may be records there as well that would support a disability identification. But schools do have a proactive obligation to identify these kids. So particularly if there is a kid who's been having ongoing behaviors in the school, there should be documentation about that that the attorney can access.
And if not, the attorney can encourage the parent to give consent to the school district to initiate an evaluation. Schools either have to do the evaluation or give prior written notice of procedural safeguards that are available to parents if they do not do the evaluation. Even if an evaluation is done and it doesn't reveal a disability and the parent thinks that's in error, the parent has the right to request an independent educational evaluation at the school district's expense. And again, the school district must either provide the evaluation, the independent evaluation as requested, or initiate an administrative hearing process to prove that its evaluation was correct. The other resource that people should be aware of is that once custody has been taken from the parents and they are a ward of the state, there's a requirement under federal and Ohio law that a surrogate parent be appointed to advocate for that child's special education rights. And juvenile courts do have the authority to appoint a surrogate parent to represent the rights of that child if there is no parent to fulfill that role. Schools may also, they also have an obligation to provide surrogates, but sometimes they don't follow through on that. So the juvenile court is another avenue in which to get somebody there involved looking after the child's education rights.
What we see a lot, particularly for kids who are not in their parents' custody anymore, who might be out of the home, maybe in a state facility, is that the school district can be missing in action in a lot of those cases. And it happens particularly when children are placed in a facility that's far away from their local school district. And in those cases, kids are particularly vulnerable because there usually isn't somebody advocating for their special education rights. The parents' rights have been terminated. There's no surrogate appointed, and those kids are really missing out. So those are kids you have to watch with a critical eye, I think.
And if there's a dispute between school districts as who's supposed to be responsible for a child, because a lot of these children, as we said, move from place to place to place, the juvenile court has the ability to determine which school district is responsible. The way it's supposed to work is the district where the child is physically located has the obligation to provide the services, but the district, what's called the district of resident, where the child came from, where the parent was, the last known address, would be responsible for payment. And certainly there are districts that say the kid's not living here anymore, it's not a responsibility, and the district where the youth is living says they're not a resident here, they're only here for treatment, and those kind of disputes happen. Sometimes the school district of residence doesn't even know where the kid is. So advocates and attorneys can help to bridge those gaps and to ensure that services are provided appropriately so that it will be easier for reentry when the child is ready to go back to their home community.
I think something too that gets lost in this whole mix is the voice of the student, particularly for kids who are older. My experience has been that the most successful reentry plans and most successful behavior intervention plans were developed with the student. And the student was the one who had the ideas about what types of supports and services would be helpful to them and what kind of modifications would make it easier for them to stay in school and learn. So as advocates, I think we don't want to lose sight of that, is that self-advocacy and empowerment is really powerful and is often what it takes to recapture a kid who's been lost in a system.
And as you point out, Kristen, not only is it important for likelihood of success, but it's required that the child be invited once they turn 16 to at least be involved in what's called transition planning. Services have to be provided to transition that youth to adulthood. And it's not just, post-secondary education or vocational education. It includes services that are necessary for the student to live independently as an adult. And so it can be living skills, other kinds of things that may not be traditionally viewed as academic topics. So it's not only a good idea, it's required at age 16.
Are there other legal issues that children's attorneys should be aware of anything about maybe if you're representing a youth with behavioral disabilities, the impact of understanding legal proceedings or other issues that advocates should be aware of.
There has been a draft of a bill floating around in Ohio about competency, determining competency of juveniles. And at this point, because there really is no clear requirements, it's different in every court. There's a lot of research that suggests that youth really don't have the mature good decisions until well after the age of 21, that they really kind of lack the capacity to make informed decisions. But you know, and that's certainly going to be a hard sell in the legal arena. But certainly with kids with disabilities, particularly cognitive disabilities or impulse control issues, it should be a factor in any kind of defense in the juvenile court process. And again, having expert testimony, having records to support that argument is absolutely critical. But many times, you know, it's difficult for children to understand or the implications of their behavior or to control their behavior. And certainly the court process is even more complex, requires a higher level of understanding, and even to be able to assist the defender in defense of the charges that have been filed against this child. So it certainly is something to be aware of and a strategy to be considered. And the idea isn't to get the child off. It's to get the child the services that they need so that they can become a well-functioning, law-abiding citizen.
I think both of you mentioned parents, and that's a key factor in all of this. Is there anything we can do as a community or as advocates to help parents more in advocating and understanding the rights of their children?
Where do we begin?
Well, you have 13
spent
28 minutes.
Years doing that. I've spent 21 or 22.
I don't think the show is long enough for us to give you all of the answers to that.
Well,
seriously,
I think there is a real lack of attorneys or advocates in the state of Ohio who are knowledgeable about special education, who can assist parents, and a lot of them who are in private practice obviously need to charge for their work. So, you know, it's difficult for families to find seasoned special ed attorneys or to afford them if they can't get free services from Ohio Legal Rights Service. So that's a huge issue. There are entities in the state who provide what are called parent mentors for parents, but they're not available in every district. It's through the Ohio Coalition for the Education of Children with Disabilities. So there are some resources out there, but there's a big lack of resources. So we've made some efforts to try to provide training to other legal service attorneys on special education in the hopes that they would branch out and help represent parents. So it's a serious issue. We laugh about it, but it's a serious issue. There aren't enough people out there to meet the demand.
And unfortunately, the legal services, the legal aides in Ohio, have suffered tremendous losses because of the economy. The funds that they get from interest-bearing accounts from attorneys in the private sector have plunged. And so while they were starting to build up their special education practice, many of them have cut them, and there are very few legal services attorneys who are available to do this work. And, of course, there's a huge gap. Even if there were legal services attorneys, there are many, many parents who would not be eligible based on the poverty guidelines for legal services, but still cannot afford to pay what it costs to do these cases. They're extremely expensive if the case goes through administrative hearing and appeals. But there are other resources available. The Ohio Department of Education offers mediation at no cost, and they have trained mediators who will go throughout the state to sit down with school officials and parents to try and collaboratively and civilly work out solutions. There is also, because the hearing process can be so costly, and it's really like a court hearing, it's less formal, but it's adversarial. There are, you know, briefs filed and witnesses called and cross-examination, and it's a very legalistic process. There's an alternative process where an attorney really isn't required, and while it's not technically required for administrative hearings, it's highly advisable. The school districts are always represented by very seasoned attorneys. So This other process is the state complaint system through the Ohio Department of Education, and there's information on the Ohio Department of Education's website. There's a form that you can download. You cannot file it online, but you can download it and use it as a template so that you're sure to hit all the marks that you need to fill in to have a complaint that they will process. If there are certain fatal flaws, then you're going to have to start over. But the beauty of the state complaint system is that you don't need an attorney, and the state can do an independent investigation. They have access to the school's records, and within 60 days of the filing of your complaint, they will issue what is called a letter of findings. And if they find violations of any of the issues you have raised in your complaint, they will require the school district to develop a corrective action plan, and all corrective action needs to be completed no later than a year, and most of it should be completed much sooner than that. And one of the remedies, for example, if a child has been expelled or suspended inappropriately, the state can order that compensatory education be provided by the school district to make up for the loss of those services that the school should have been providing to the student. The other beauty of the state complaint is, unlike an impartial due process hearing, the administrative hearing process, anybody having knowledge can file a state complaint. What attorneys refer to as standing isn't an issue. So even if you're not the parent of the child, if you're an advocate, if you're a guardian ad litem, if you're a teacher, if you're a neighbor, anyone having knowledge of a violation of federal special education law can file a state complaint with the Ohio Department of Education. Now, you may not be able to get access to all the information if you're not the parent, but it is a way to get violations of the law corrected. If you file a state complaint, you'll be offered mediation, and many, many times schools will agree to the mediation rather than have a finding of violation of the law from the state. So mediation is also available if you file for an administrative hearing, but it's available even if you don't file a state complaint or for administrative hearing. So it's a good resource. In addition, the state also offers facilitated IEP meetings. We spoke about the individualized education plan that schools are required to do. Develop for children with disabilities who are eligible for special education. And a lot of times these disputes about whether the behavior is a manifestation of the disability, whether there's been a functional behavioral assessment, or whether the behavior plan is appropriate or not, can be addressed through the facilitated IEP process. And again, these are the trained mediators who help the party sit down and try and come up with a solution. So there are many things available that don't necessarily require an attorney to try and address these issues that people should avail themselves of. And all that information is on the Ohio Department of Education's website. If you go to the Office for Exceptional Children section of that, you should be able to find those resources.
There are also good, resources available online for parents about a variety of special education issues specific to the issue we're talking about today, the school-to-prison pipeline. Our office has an online tutorial that people can take specific to this issue. Also, there's an organization called the Advancement Project. They have a great website. It's www.advancementproject.org, and they focus primarily on the school-to-prison pipeline and do a lot of work with school districts throughout the country to modify their zero-tolerance policies and create school-wide policies for positive behavioral supports. The ACLU also has a very fun pipeline game and other resources on their website. It's www.aclu.org, and they have a school-to-prison pipeline game that is made actually looks like plumbing. So it's fun to take it. Fun and sad, I guess, at the same time. And then the other thing I think that we should tell advocates is that parent support groups can be very helpful to parents in special education, and you know, just like the autism community has banded together to do amazing things about awareness and increasing services to kids with autism, there are other support groups out there for parents of kids with disabilities, and many of those parents have special education difficulties in common and can support each other, and especially since they may have been through the same process that a parent is having trouble with. So that's a way for parents, I think, to get some support through the system if they can't access an attorney or advocate.
Well, I want to make sure you did not give your own website address.
I would, but I don't actually know it. Isn't that terrible?
I think I do. olrs.ohio.gov. And so we are almost out of time. Do both of you have some final comments you want to share?
I would just urge parents who are having these kinds of problems to call Ohio Legal Rights Service. We have a toll-free number that they can call, and it's 1-800-282-9181. Our intake is manned with live individuals Monday through Friday from 9 to 4. People can also submit requests through the web, and we have answering machines on the weekends and evenings. But if you are having these kinds of problems or you just want information, please feel free to call our intake line, and I'm the person who will review those requests. So I guarantee you, you will get an answer or response within a few business days of your request.
And I would also add, if you are not a parent, but you are an attorney or an advocate or somebody in the court system who wants some information as well, we are available to help with that.
We can come out and do trainings for folks. Kristen has done a lot of that, and I've done some of that as well.
Wonderful. Well, Soon, Kristen, thank you so much for being on today's show, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. I'd also like to thank Ansa, who's behind the scenes answering calls. Today's her last day with the Children's Law Center, so I want to wish her luck in all her future ventures. This show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. Our next show will be in May, highlighting Lighthouse Youth Services, a multi-service agency operating 19 different programs and a charter school, all dedicated to improving the lives of youth. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on You. Thank you, Sue, Kristen, again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.